Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And fresh out of my mailbox just about 30 minutes ago was the June 2025 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And we're going to read from this today. And if you remember correctly, there was a lot of news about The Atlantic and its editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, who was put in the email distribution of some rather sensitive Pentagon pieces. And the first few articles here are about that particular instance. And we're going to start with an article by Jeffrey Goldberg about that. And it is headlined, Signalgate, Trump, and The Atlantic. This month's cover story is written by two of our newest reporters, Ashley Parker and Michael Scherer. Both came to The Atlantic from The Washington Post, where they covered the White House and national politics. As one might expect, they have developed complicated and intriguing ideas about the brain of Donald Trump and the nature of Trumpism. A simple question animates their story. How did Trump rise from political ruin in 2021 to seize the commanding heights of government and the world economy? One is not required to admire Trump to acknowledge that he has become the most consequential American political figure of the 21st century, and that we all live inside a reality he has made and makes anew every day. As you will read, Trump himself has an understanding of his power. The first time I had two things to do, run the country and survive. I had all these crooked guys, he told Michael and Ashley. He was referring, it seemed, to anyone who'd investigated him. And the second time, he added, I run the country and the world. Covering Trump is a challenge for White House reporters. It is true that he never stops talking, so he provides the press with limitless fodder. But it's also true that he tries to intimidate reporters. And crucially, the people who own news organizations in ways that are clearly dangerous to democracy. I reported on the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and though some stories displeased them and periodically made them angry, they responded with the self-restraint one traditionally associates with the presidency. Trump, by contrast, makes his feelings known in visceral and cutting ways, with the intent to humiliate and intimidate, except when he doesn't. I recently joined Michael and Ashley in the Oval Office for a meeting with the president. The odd circumstances of this interview were described in their cover story, also described, and the new decor of the Oval Office. What I found in particular meeting was a Trump who was low-key, attentive, and eager to convince us that he is good at his job and good for the country. It isn't easy to escape the tractor beam of his charisma, but somehow we managed, and we asked him what needed to be asked by squaring Trump the charmer with the Trump we more frequently see is difficult. Ashley and Michael describe in sometimes amusing detail their encounters with Trump, and I will spoil nothing more here. But at one point in the reporting process, Trump posted on the social media platform he owns that Ashley is a radical left lunatic. She is not. And that Michael has never written a fair story about me, only negative, and virtually always lies. Also false. It is our task at The Atlantic not to be bullied by these sorts of attacks. No case. We have a job to do. The president first called The Atlantic a failing magazine nearly 5 years ago, after I reported that he had slandered veterans and fallen soldiers as suckers and losers. I will note the for posterity that the Atlantic was not profitable then, but it is now, and has doubled its number of subscribers in the intervening years. Recently, Trump made the same sort of attack after I was inadvertently included in a Signal group chat with senior administration officials. That chat, which focused on an upcoming military strikes against terrorists in Yemen, included the vice president, the CIA director, and much of the president's cabinet. The outlandish details of the episode, labeled inevitably Signalgate, are well known. What interests me about Signalgate is as much of its inherent absurdity as the administration's response to the controversy. And our cover story reported as the Signal controversy was unfolding, Ashley and Michael describe in absorbing detail Trump's belief acquired in his four-year Joe Biden-induced exile that no stove is too hot to touch, and also his conviction refined after much experimentation that normative reality does not exist. The second notion governs Trump's answer to anyone who challenges him. A different sort of president would have responded to the revelations of Signalgate, in which his national security team did just about the stupidest thing imaginable, by fixing the problem directly and quickly. First, acknowledge a mistake, then apologize, promise to investigate, and then offer a plan to keep something like this from happening again. End of story. Not so with Signalgate or anything else. The administration responded immediately, resuscitating its failing magazine line of attack. Trump said of me, "I've known him for a long time, and he is truly a sleazeball." Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called me a deceitful and highly discredited so-called journalist. And Michael Waltz, the National Security Advisor, who is one who mistakenly included me in the chat, said that I was the bottom scum of journalists and a loser. The episode called to mind an earlier moment when Trump described me as a horrible radical left lunatic, and one of my children noted, with some amusement, "You're not left-wing." Waltz, whom I previously knew to be a smart person, who also alleged that I had sucked my number into his phone. The name-calling matters less than the fact that Trump argued against all available evidence that they revealed no secrets and done nothing wrong. Denial and attack have worked exceedingly well for Trump, as Michael Ashley note in their story. Trump's decision to foment the January 6th insurrection would normally have ended his political career, but it didn't. Trump called the insurrection a day of love, and his decision at the onset of his second term to pardon or commute the sentences of the insurrectionists, transforming even those who assaulted police officers into victims of prosecutors, only made him more powerful. But there are limits. The limits come when people choose steadfastness over cowardice. Too many Republican senators live in fear of Trump. There are media companies that have paid to his administration, Jeff Bezos posts among them, and law firms and corporations and even universities. These institutions are making strange and bad choices. After we published our first story on Signal controversy, the Trump administration accused us of lying. It said we were trafficking in falsehoods, that there was nothing sensitive and or secret about the material its members had transmitted. The administration's knee-jerk response forced us to release the Signal chat, which showed conclusively that Waltz, Hegseth, and others were doing all sorts of things that serious national security professionals would never do. The point of journalism is to hold the powerful to account by encouraging our journalists to go where the truth takes them, and by hiring stellar reporters such as Ashley and Michael. I believe that we are fulfilling the Atlantic's mission. Our challenge, Caitlin Flanagan often says that the truth bats last. I believe she is right. And that was Signalgate, Trump, and the Atlantic by Jeffrey Goldberg, who is the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. And that is in the June 2025 issue of the magazine. And let's go ahead and read that feature article by Ashley Parker and Michael Shever. And it is headlined, Donald Trump is enjoying this. The president explains how he plans to change America forever. Before we begin, a primer on the science of arranging an interview with a sitting American president. In ordinary times, reporters seeking an on-the-record encounter with the commander-in-chief first write an elaborate proposal. The proposal details the goals of the interview, the broad areas of concern, and the many reasons the president must, for his own good, talk to these particular reporters and not other perfectly adequate ones, but still lesser reporters. The pitch is then sent to the White House officials. If the universe bends favorably, negotiations ensue. If staff feel reasonably confident that the interview will somehow help their cause, they will talk to the president, with trepidation at times, to sit for an interview. Sometimes the president will agree. Such is what happened recently to us. We went through this process in the course of reporting the story you were reading. We made our pitch, which went like this. President Donald Trump, by virtue of winning a second term and so dramatically reshaping the country and the world, can now be considered the most consequential American leader in the 21st century, and we want to describe in detail how this came to be. Just 4 years ago, after the violent insurrection he fomented, Trump appeared to be finished. Social media companies had banned or suspended him, and he had been repudiated by corporate donors. Republicans had denounced him, and the country was moving on to the fresh start of Joe Biden's presidency. Then came further blows, the indictments, the civil judgments, and the endless disapprovals by people who once worked for him. And yet, here we are, months into a second Trump term. We wanted to hear in his own words how he pulled off one of the most remarkable comebacks in political history and what lessons, if any, he'd internalized along the way. Trump agreed to see us. We were tentatively promised a meeting and a photo shoot, likely in the Oval Office, though possibly the Lincoln bedroom. But then, as is so often the case with the White House, everything went sideways. The week our interview was supposed to occur, Trump posted a message on Truth Social attacking us by name. Ashley Parker is not capable of doing a fair and unbiased interview. She's a radical left lunatic and has been as terrible as possible for as long as I have known her, he wrote. To this date, she doesn't even know that I won the presidency 3 times. The last sentence is true. Ashley Parker does not know that Trump won the presidency 3 times. Likewise, Michael Scher has never written a fair story about me, only negative and virtually always lies. Apparently, as word of our meeting spread through Trump's inner circle, someone had reminded him of some of the things we, specifically Ashley, had said and written that he didn't like. We still don't know who it is, but we immediately understood the consequences. No photo shoot, no tour of the newly redecorated Oval Office or the Lincoln bedroom, and definitely no interview. But we've both covered Trump long enough to know that the first word is rarely his final one. So at 10:45 on a Saturday morning in late March, we called him on his cell phone. Don't ask me how we got his number. All we can say is that the White House staff has imperfect control over Trump's personal communication devices. The president was at the country club he owns at Bedminster, New Jersey. The number that flashed on the screen was an unfamiliar one, but he answered anyway. "Who's calling?" he asked. Despite his attacks on us a few days earlier, The president, evidently feeling buoyed by a week of successes, was eager to talk about his accomplishments. As we spoke, the sounds of another conversation, perhaps from a television, hummed in the background. The president seemed exhilarated by everything he had managed to do in the first 2 months of his second term. He had begun a purge of diversity efforts from the federal government, granted clemency to nearly 1,600 supporters who had participated in the invasion of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, including those caught beating police officers on camera, and signed 98 executive orders and counting, 26 of them on his first day in office. He had fired independent regulators, gutted entire agencies, laid off great swaths of the federal workforce, and invoked 18th century wartime powers to use against a criminal gang in Venezuela. He had adjusted tariffs like a DJ spinning knobs in a booth, upsetting the rhythms of global trade and inducing vertigo in the financial markets. He had raged at the leader of Ukraine, a democratic ally repelling an imperialistic invasion, not for not being thankful, and praised the leader of an invading country, Russia, as very smart, reversing an instant 80 years of U.S. foreign policy doctrine and prompting the countries of NATO to prepare for their own defense without the protective umbrella of American power for the first time since 1945. He had empowered one of his top political donors, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, to slice away at the federal government and take control of its operating systems. He had disemboweled ethics and anti-corruption architecture installed after Watergate and had declared that he, not the Attorney General, was the nation's chief law enforcement officer. He had revoked Secret Service protection and security clearances from political opponents, including some facing Iranian death threats for carrying out actions Trump himself had ordered in the first term. He had announced plans to pave over part of the Rose Garden, and he had redecorated the Oval Office, gold trim and gold trophies and gold frames to go with an array of past president portraits, making the room look like a Palm Beach approximation of an 18th century royal court. Old foes were pleading for his grace. Meta, whose founder Mark Zuckerberg had become an enthusiastic supplicant, had paid $25 million to settle a civil lawsuit with Trump that many experts believed was meritless. Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, announced that he was banning his opinion writers from holding certain opinions, and then joined Trump for dinner at the same night as the White House. "He's 100%. He's been great," the president told us, referring to Bezos. "Zuckerberg's been great." We asked Trump why he thought the billionaire class was prostrating itself before him. "It's just a higher level of respect. I don't know," Trump said. "Maybe they didn't know me at the beginning, and now they know me." "I mean, you saw yesterday with the law firm," he said. He was referring to Paul Weiss, Ritkin, Morton, and Garrison, one of the nation's most prestigious firms, whose leader had come to the Oval Office days later to beg for relief from an executive order that could have crippled its business. Trump had issued that order at least partially because a former partner at the firm had in 2021 gone to work for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, where he was part of an investigation of the Trump Organization business practices. Also that week, an Ivy League institution threatened with the cancellation of $400 million in federal funding, had agreed to overhaul its Middle Eastern Studies program at the Trump administration request, also acceding to other significant demands. "You saw yesterday with Columbia University. What do you think of the law firm? Were you shocked at that?" Trump asked us. "Yes, all of it was shocking, much of it without precedent. Legal scholars were drawing comparison to Franklin D. Roosevelt and the early stages of the New Deal, when Congress had allowed FDR to demolish norms and greatly expand the powers of the presidency. As ever, Trump was on the hunt for a deal. If he liked the story we wrote, he said, he might even speak to us again. Tell the people at The Atlantic if they write good stories and truthful stories, the magazine would be hot. Perhaps the magazine can risk foregoing hotness, he suggested, because it's owned by Laverne Powell Jobs, who buffers it, and he implied, from commercial imperatives. But that doesn't guarantee anything, he warned. You know at some point they give up, he said, referring to media owners generally, and we suspected Bezos specifically. At some point they say, no, no, MDs, no. And he laughed quietly. Media owners weren't the only ones on his mind. He also seemed to be referring to law firms, universities, broadcast networks, tech titans, artists, research scientists, military commanders, civil servants, and moderate Republicans. All people and institutions had expected to eventually, inevitably, submit to his will. We asked the president if his second term felt different from his first. He said it did. The first time I had two things to do, run the country and survive. I had all these crooked guys, he said, and the second time I run the country and the world. For weeks, we've been hearing from both inside and outside the White House that the president was having more fun than he'd had in his first term. The first time, the first weeks, it was just, let's blow this place up, Brian Ballard, a lobbyist and an ally of the president, told us. This time, he's blowing it up with a twinkle in his eye. When we put this observation to Trump over the phone, he agreed. I'm having a lot of fun, considering what I do, he said. You know, what I do is such serious stuff. That Trump now finds himself once again in a position to blow things up is astonishing, considering the depth of his fall. So much has happened so fast that the improbability of his comeback gets obscured. Perhaps no one in American history has had a political resurrection as remarkable as Donald Trump's. In the waning days of his first term, his approval rating stood at a pallid 34%. A few weeks earlier, he had watched on television while an insurrection he incited overran the Capitol. Polls showed that a clear majority of Americans believe he bore responsibility for the attack. The House of Representatives had just impeached him for a second time, making him the only president to ever achieve that indignity. And although the Senate failed to reach the two-thirds majority required for conviction, seven Republican senators voted to convict. The most members of a president's own party to vote for impeachment, conviction in history. Twitter and Facebook, his favorite social media platforms, had banned or effectively silenced him, along with Instagram and YouTube. To try to reestablish direct connection with his followers, he would launch a blog, From the Desk of Donald J. Trump, but he gained little traction and was abandoned within weeks. Major corporations announced that they were cutting off political contributions to officials who had supported Trump's election lies. Deutsche Bank and Signature Bank decided to stop doing business with Trump and his companies. Perhaps most painful to the president, the PGA of America yanked its scheduled 2022 championship tournament from Trump's Bedminster golf course. Former members of his own cabinet and staff, people who had hired, would declare him, or had already declared him, a moron. That's what Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, said. More dangerous than anyone could ever imagine. That was from James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. The most flawed person I've ever met, said John Kelly, Chief of Staff, and a laughing fool, John Bolton, National Security Advisor, said. And now longtime allies were abandoning him. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House Minority Leader, had discussed pushing Trump to resign from office. On the evening of the insurrection, Senator Lindsey Graham, a compass reliably magnetized towards whatever power in the Republican lies, pointed away from Trump for the first time in 4 years. "Count me out," Graham had declared on the Senate floor. "Enough is enough." Rupert Murdoch, then the chairman of Fox Corporation, sent an email to a former Fox Broadcasting executive in which he declared, "We want to make Trump a non-person." Coming from Murdoch himself, the former Trump advisor Steve Bannon told us recently, "That's a papal bull." On the morning of Joe Biden's inauguration, Trump was a dozen miles southeast of the festivities at Joint Base Andrews, preparing to depart for Florida. Trump was the first president preparing since Andrew Johnson in 1869 to boycott the swearing-in of his successor. Standing before a modest crowd, his dark overcoat a meager bulwark against the cold, the soon-to-be former president cut a diminished figure. Just before boarding Air Force One for the final time to head to Mar-a-Lago, Trump spoke to those gathered to bid him farewell. "We'll be back in some form," he said, a notably modest framing from such a formerly oversized figure. Few believed him. It didn't even sound like he believed it himself. The Trump era was over. Almost as soon as Trump arrived at the Gilded Elba, he began plotting his return. He missed the press pool, the gaggle of reporters that tails every president, and once tried to summon it, only to be told that no such pool still existed. But it would turn out that the lack of attention in those first few months and the lack of access to social media platforms was a blessing. Enforced obscurity gave him time and clarity he needed to plan his comeback. To understand how Trump rose from the political dead and how it set himself up to wield power in a second term, we spoke with dozens of top advisors, senior aides, allies, adversaries, and confidants. Many who talked with us did so only on condition of anonymity in order to be more candid and to avoid angering the president. The story they told us revealed that Trump's time in the political wilderness is critical to understanding the way he's exercising power now. He had been in Palm Beach a week when an opportunity presented itself. Trump heard that Kevin McCarthy would be in South Florida for fundraisers. Though the two men had clashed after the Capitol riot, Trump invited McCarthy to Mar-a-Lago. Even before the meeting happened, news of it leaked to the New York Times, shaking the political universe. Were Republican leaders who had seemed so intent on purging Trump embracing him again? When Trump and McCarthy met in person, the former president asked the minority leader who had tipped off the time. "I know who leaked it. You did," McCarthy replied. Multiple people briefed in the exchange told us. "It's good for both of us," Trump shot back. Both men were right. McCarthy had already concluded that the path back to Republican control of the House in the 2022 midterms and his own path to the speakership required a unified party, one that included Trump and his MAGA base. After the meeting, each man separately released the same photo, the two of them grinning amid ostentatious splendor of Mar-a-Lago. Trump had taken the first step towards political redemption. It is a truism that Trump had never felt governed by the traditional rules of politics, and he had always been convinced of his own genius, his pure gut instincts, but never more so than today. His past 4 years have turned him into a Nietzschean cliché. Banishment, multiple indictments, a 34-count felony conviction, repeated brushes with assassins, all have combined to convince him that he is impervious to challenges and would destroy others. Those years strengthened in him the salesman instinct that he can bend reality to his will, turn facts into fake news, make the inconceivable not just conceivable but actual, transform the Gulf of Mexico into the Gulf of America, make people believe that he's sailing in defiance of what they see with their own eyes. This is what the core lesson that this is the core lesson that Trump and his acolytes internalized from the 2020 election and January 6th. The real estate mogul who branded buildings with his name everywhere from Turkey to Uruguay, who sold the world's greatest steaks and the finest wine and fantastic mattresses, had mastered the alchemy of perception. Reality to Trump is fungible. While reporting on Trump over the past 4 years, we were repeatedly struck that, in failing to drive a stake directly through his heart, all of the would-be vampire slayers, Democrats, never-Trumpers, Republican primary opponents, prosecutors, judges, media critics, only strengthened him. Which brings us to a second lesson. Trump and his team realized that they could behave with near impunity by embracing controversies and scandals that would have taken down just about any other president as long as they showed no weakness. Even now, Trump, who described himself as a very positive thinker, struggles to admit that his return to power was a comeback. To concede that he had to come back would be so to admit that he had fallen in the first place. And we're about halfway through today's show, and I was just looking. This article is very long, so this might be part one of two that we finish next week. But anyway, I just wanted to remind everybody that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And remember, if you missed the beginning of this, you can go back and listen to it from the top simply by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app on your tablet or on your phone. And then if you go there, you can get the live feeds and stream from Tempe, from Flagstaff, and from Tucson. And if you scroll down a little bit more from there, you will see all the shows that are broadcast on Sun Sounds of Arizona and a lot more besides. And you can find this show, Points of View, in the entertainment section. Okay, let's get back to this very interesting piece of journalism about Donald Trump and these two reporters from The Atlantic. Earlier in our reporting for this article, we asked Trump loyalist and former Breitbart News editor Raheem Kassam to explain how the president had been able to bend the country and the world to his will. Over a meal of oyster brulees, duck confit, and fries cooked in beef tallow at Butterworth's, the new MAGA haunt on Capitol Hill, he responded crudely, if vividly. He didn't bend them to his will, Kassam says. He bent over them. When we spoke with Trump in late March, his approval ratings seemed steady, his political base apparently unshakable. Institution after institution was submitting to him, obeying in advance, as a historian of authoritarianism, Timothy Snyder, has put it. Trump was carrying out his agenda with surprisingly little resistance, even from the Democrats. But in the days and weeks that followed, the patina of infallibility began to crack. At the instigation of Elon Musk's Doge team, critical workers had been getting fired and then hired back, an embarrassing and possibly illegal Operation Security snafu, in which the editor of this magazine was included in a Signal group chat that discussed intimate attack plans on Houthi targets in Yemen made at the administration look incompetent. In a fashion reminiscent of the clown car chaos of Trump 1.0, the president's tariff rollout was shambolic, tanking the stock market and causing even some loyalists to question him publicly. His approval rating on the economy, long a buttress of his polling support, went negative. Was this what happens when a feeling of indomitability curdles into hubris? Or was it just the next setback for Trump, some combination of Houdini and Lazarus to recover from? Trump advisors like to tell a story from November 5th, 2024, election night, just before the network called Wisconsin and thus the election in his favor. He and his aides were preparing to head to the West Palm Beach Convention Center, where he would deliver his victory speech. His whole senior team was crowded into his private office at Mar-a-Lago, addressing no one in particular, as though just musing aloud. Trump spoke. "You know, they made a big mistake," he said. "They could have been getting rid of us by now, but actually we're just beginning." He had almost been destroyed before. After a real estate downturn in the early 1990s, Trump found himself on the brink of financial ruin. His near bankruptcy and recovery led to his 1997 book, The Art of the Comeback. For his political advisors in exile, this book became essential reading. The first pages list Trump's top 10 comeback tips. When we met one of his advisors recently, this person recounted from memory some of those rules on the list. Rule 1 is, play golf, this another advisor told us. Rule 9 is, get even. Rule 10, always have a prenuptial agreement, seemed less applicable to politics. To stage a comeback, Trump would need the right staff. He had realized, in his exile, that at nearly every turn in his first term, someone on his own team, Reese Priebus, John Kelly, James Mattis, Bill Barr, Gary Cohn, had blocked him. He needed smart people who would figure out how to let him do everything that he wanted to do, in whatever way they wanted to do it. His first key hire was a political operative who had impressed the former president with her retrospective analysis of the 2020 election. Biden had won the election that year by flipping back into the Democratic column five key states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, along with a lone congressional district in Nebraska. One of the few bright spots for Trump in 2020 had been Florida, where he had increased his winning margin from 2016. What Trump began asking his allies after the election, had he done right in Florida, and what he had done right for the rest of the country? The answer, in large part, boiled down to Susie Wiles, who had run Trump's 2016 and 2020 campaign in the state. Wiles, the daughter of the legendary NFL announcer Pete Summerall and an experienced campaign operative, she was a scheduler for Ronald Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign, who over the past three decades had developed deep Florida ties. After every campaign she runs, Wiles writes an after-action report documenting what worked and what didn't. Over dinner with Trump on the patio at Mar-a-Lago in early 2021, she delivered the Florida memo. Soon after, he hired her to run his political operation, which eventually became his 2024 campaign. Wiles saw the one thing that held Trump back in 2020 was that he had not finished taking over the Republican Party during the first term. Part of Trump's leverage had been his ability to endorse in Republican primaries, influence who was eager to reprise. "When I endorse somebody, they win," Trump told us on the phone. "But even when I endorse them in general election, mostly they win. It's important. Now, when Trump calls to pressure a fellow Republican about an issue or a vote, they are almost always grateful for his past support or feel that they owe their seat to him." The Wiles process for evaluating potential endorsees, which she undertook with James Blair, now a deputy chief of staff in the White House, and Brian Jack, now a congressman representing Georgia, involved researching how they had spoken about Trump in the past. The basic thing was their loyalty and their political viability, one advisor told us. So we're looking for things like, so what did they say on J6? What did they say during the Access Hollywood tape? What was their voting record with us? Trump was building a coalition of loyalists, something he hadn't sufficiently done during his first term. Wiles had plenty of experience managing men with big personalities, but colleagues say a key reason she's been successful working with Trump, she's now his White House chief of staff, is that she never tries to manage him. She does not imagine that she can control him, as some former advisors attempted, and she tends not to offer advice unless specifically asked. Her primary role, as she sees it, is to set up processes to help ensure Trump's success, and then to execute his directives, whatever they may be. At first, Trump's banishment from big social media platforms, along with mainstream media outlets' reluctance, including Fox News's, to give him much coverage, seemed potentially devastating. But Trump turned to the far-right platforms and activists still welcoming him. Taylor Bunovich, now a White House deputy chief of staff, worked with MAGA influencers to evade the Twitter and Facebook bans. They would print out pro-Trump social media posts. Bunovich would have Trump sign the paper with his Sharpie and then mail the signed post back to the influencer. Almost invariably, the influencer would then post the signed missive, flexing their access and building their audience, while simultaneously amplifying Trump's voice. At the same time, a video ecosystem grew up around Trump, with streaming platforms such as Right Side Broadcasting Network stepping in to cover his events when cable networks would not. Him being banned gave rise to people like me, because the president's supporters followed me to find out what he was trying, one MAGA influencer told us. It backfired on the tech people who deplatformed him, because it platformed all of us. Trump, meanwhile, continued to promote the lie that he'd won the 2020 election and that the January 6th was just an ordinary Wednesday. Normal political logic suggested that this was a bad strategy, but his shamelessness, as ever, remained a strength. By repeating something frequently enough, he could slowly make it feel true, at least for his supporters. Not long ago, we sat in Steve Bannon's Capitol Hill row house, where he records his War Room podcast, pressing him on Trump's refusal to accept the results of the 2020 election and his denial of what transpired on January 6th. Our reality is that we won, and that January 6th was a Fedsurrection, Bannon said, referring to the conspiracy theory that FBI agents had incited the crowd on the Ellipse that day. But this reality, we pointed out to Bannon, is simply not true. Now, here's the interesting thing, Bannon said. Who's won the argument? I think we have. The first televised hearing of the House subcommittee on January 6th was scheduled for the beginning of June 2022, and it was sure to be a spectacle that reminded viewers of the horror of the insurrection and emphasized the former president's culpability. Trump's team at Mar-a-Lago was desperate to distract attention from the hearing. At one point, someone proposed a brazen gambit. Trump could announce his 2024 bid for the presidency just minutes before the hearing gaveled in. Trump's response was telling. I'm not ready for this, he said. We're not ready for this right now. And this was the first moment of like, okay, he's not just thinking about it. He's seriously thinking about how he wants to do it, one of his advisors told us. He's not going to just use this as a stunt to make a moment. He wants to win. Before long, Trump began emphasizing behind the scenes that he was serious. Be ready, he would repeat to people who had served with him the first time around. Be ready, we're coming back, be ready. Still, when Trump did launch his campaign in November 2022, it did not get off to an auspicious start. Even the most fiercely supportive advisors concede that the announcement in the form of an hour-long speech at Mar-a-Lago was a dud. Surprisingly few political reporters from major outlets were in attendance. It was as though the mainstream media still didn't believe that Trump would be a viable candidate again. Worse, some members of Trump's own family hadn't bothered to show up. As the speech dragged on, even Fox News cut away, switching to what Bannon called a C-level panel, before returning to the final few minutes. The campaign struggled to gain traction. Trump's longtime pollster, Tony Fabrizio, told us that even months later, into early 2023, getting donors to attend the first big Super PAC event was like pulling teeth. And although Trump was now a declared presidential candidate, his team said it was still having trouble getting him booked even on shows such as Fox and Friends. The first turning point, several advisors told us, came in February 2023. A Norfolk Southern train carrying hazardous chemicals derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, near the Pennsylvania border, spewing toxic materials. Sitting in West Palm Beach campaign headquarters one day, Trump's team watched Joe Biden's press secretary struggle to answer a question about the president's plans for outreach to East Palestine. Soon after, Susan Wiles received a call from Trump's oldest son, Don Jr., saying that his father ought to just show up there himself. When Wiles brought the suggestion to Trump in the living room of Mar-a-Lago, his response was unequivocal. "That's a great idea," he enthused. "When can we go?" Trump's visit to East Palestine and the footage of him buying McDonald's for first responders had a potent effect. It just reminded everyone that people still like this guy, one advisor told us. He's still a draw. Nearly 2 years later, Trump's visit continued to resonate. People are living their lives and they don't delve but easily into policy. A woman across the border in the swing state of Pennsylvania told her colleague George Packer after the election last fall, "All they know is that Trump was here buying everyone McDonald's and that Biden hadn't visited them for more than a year." The halting scar to the campaign kept Trump off the radar, giving his team time to plan. Former Trump advisors had used their years out of power to set up their own groups. America's First Legal, America's First Policy Institute, Center for Renewing America, to prepare for a second Trump administration. The people who were true believers knew that Trump was going to run again and win, Carolyn Wren, a former top Trump fundraiser, told us, adding that Trump's policy loyalists sat there and prepared executive orders for 4 years. The people who were true believers knew that Trump was going to run. This time out of the spotlight also allowed the team to build a new election strategy. By now, Trump had alienated a significant share of the voting public, and it was polling lower among some demographic groups than previous elections. The conventional wisdom was that the criminal investigations and legal proceedings then were underway only to increase his alienation. His campaign directors decided that the best tactic was to turn this problem into a strength. Chris LaCivita, who was a co-campaign manager alongside Susan Wiles and a military veteran wounded in the Gulf War in 1991, took to exhorting younger staffers with a Marine slogan, "Embrace the suck." The impulse to let Trump be Trump, so contrary to the instincts of much of the first-term staff, was laid out in a memo that James Blair and Tim Saylor, the campaign's lead data expert, sent to Wiles in early 2024. This became known around the campaign as the Genderman memo. Instead of saying, "Look, we did 2 points worse than the white suburban women between 2016 and 2020, and how do we get these points back if we did it the other way?" An advisor familiar with the memo told us, "What if we said We gained 8 points with non-college educated men. What if we won them by 12? The strategy had the benefit of letting Trump be the version of himself that appealed to those men. In a moment when the Democratic Party often felt like an amalgamation of East Coast elitists, nigging scolds, and far-left activists, Trump appeared to offer judgment-free populism to a populace sick of being judged. Trump's own view, we were told, was more self-referential. Why would I distance myself from my people? They love me. On Friday, May 31st, 2024, the day after Trump was convicted of 34 felony charges in a New York City courtroom, the treasurer at Make America Great Again Incorporated, the main super PAC supporting the former president, called his boss, Taylor Bonovich, which good news. A large wire transfer was coming, a record $15 million. The call set off an eternal scramble because the bank needed the donor's name to approve the transfer, and nobody knew who it was. Shortly thereafter, the treasurer called back. "I'm so sorry," he told Bonovich. "I misheard him. It's not $15 million, it's $50 million. "Don't be sorry," Bonovich said. The donation was eventually traced to Timothy Mellon, an heir to the Mellon banking fortune. The Democrats assumed that Trump's legal issues would politically neuter him. "A convicted felon is now seeking the office of the presidency," Biden would say. But all the scandals and controversies that would have sunk a different candidate became background static. The thing about court cases is that there were too many of them, and this is one of Trump's superpowers. He never gets just breaks the law a little bit. He does it all over the place. Sarah Longwell, a formerly Republican anti-MAGA political strategist who regularly conducts focus groups, told us, and as a result, there were so many court cases that it was just white noise to voters who couldn't tell them apart. The Democrats have remained outraged. Trump's base continued to believe his claims that all his criminal investigations in the January 6th hearings constituted a witch hunt. But for the sliver of voters that would actually decide the elections, the Democratic argument was that Trump was a threat to democracy, was far removed from their more urgent concerns about grocery prices. As time passed, Trump continued to rewrite history to turn insurrectionists into patriots. The events of January 6th receded into abstraction for many of those voters. If you said, "What's J6th?" it's like, "What is that? Bingo? Are you playing Battleship?" The advisor familiar with the gender memo told us, describing that the campaign's voter research had found, Trump's felony conviction actually proved to be a boon. It did not surprise his advisors. A year earlier, in the spring of 2023, when Trump had been indicted over hush money payments to a porn star, his support in Republican primary polls jumped 10 points within a month to more than 50%. A level that would never drop below again. In the first 3 months of 2023, MAGA Incorporated had reported raising about $600,000 in the 3 months following the indictment. The group took in nearly $13 million. Democrats had played right into their hands, Fabrizio, the Trump pollster, told us. For Trump's base, the cases were energizing, and they put his Republican primary opponents in the difficult position of having to defend Trump against lawfare, or risk being seen as supporting the Democratic position. In the final months of the campaign, Democratic strategists working for Vice President Harris focused on 7 swing states. Trump, by contrast, told aides that he wanted to put resources into picking up voters even in states he was already certain to win. "We don't want anyone to know it's a surprise, but I think we might win the popular vote," Trump would say to his advisors. "We've got to run up the score." During breaks between events, his team would place calls to groups of voters in red states and put him on the line. "This is your favorite president, Donald Trump," he'd say before launching into brief remarks. They would make calls from the motorcade for the campaign plane as many as 10 a day. In this way, working around the old mass media, Trump reached thousands of voters directly. If there was someone in America in some state still awake, Donald Trump would find a way to get to them. Chris LaCivita told us, in 2016, Trump had been so frustrated about losing the popular vote to Hillary Clinton that he'd falsely asserted, "I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." 8 years later, he didn't have to pretend. As election night gave way to dawn in Palm Beach, Trump basked in the comprehensiveness of his victory. All seven swing states and a strong showing in the popular vote tally, which he ultimately won. Several aides got calls from him around 4 a.m. "You won't believe it," Trump crowed, according to one. "I've already had 20 world leaders call me, and they all want to kiss my ass." Sometime later, Trump addressed a gathering of supporters in the living room at Mar-a-Lago. During his first term, people would say, "Yeah, he won, but he doesn't have much of a mandate." Trump told the crowd, "Now they can't say it anymore." And we are out of time. We still have a lot of this article to read, which we will continue next week. So you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and it's been a pleasure reading for you today, and we will talk to you next week for part two of this piece about Donald Trump's victory in 2024.